Dave's here to keep us up to date on all the news. Sam's got all of the sports. Producer David is in for Jasmine today. Of course, we're on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin, on Twitter at @SundaySpin, and engineer Bob is looking for leftover Fannie Mae chocolates for Mother's Day. Remember, if you have to tune away, you can find our shows on WGNRadio.com. You can also get our podcasts at WGNRadio.com and also at iTunes by searching for my name, Rick Pearson. Up ahead today, after Dave gives us the 7:30 news update, we'll be speaking to Republican State Senator Bill Brady of Bloomington. Senator Brady is in the Senate GOP leadership, and he's one of the negotiators on those efforts to craft a grand bargain to end the state's historic budget stalemate. Dave's back with a news update at 8, and then we'll speak to Democratic State Senator Michael Hastings of Tinley Park. The senator is the sponsor of that Right to Know bill that we talked about last week that's generated some controversy in Springfield among the business community. And then we'll speak to Ra Joy. He's the executive director of Change Illinois. We'll be talking to him about the latest effort in Springfield to advance a plan for automatic voter registration in the state. What a week it was. I mean, just think, about a week ago, we were talking about President Trump's big win with House Republicans passing their plan to repeal and replace Obamacare, even holding a Rose Garden party. But Trump is finding Washington's got a lot of thorns in the Rose Garden with his sudden firing of FBI Director James Comey. White House blames it on Comey's investigation and treatment of Hillary Clinton in the email case. Then White House thought Democrats would come to their side. White House is saying lots of things, including that Trump relied on the recommendation of Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein. But then Donald Trump says something else, and Rosenstein saying he didn't recommend Comey's firing and he doesn't want to wear the jacket for it. You've got the president contradicting his spokespeople, his surrogates. He said he was going to fire Comey no matter what the recommendation was. But it's hard not to think that Trump is tired of the Russia investigation. And now he's exacerbated all of that by raising questions that he's trying to quash it. Speaking to NBC's Lester Holt, Trump said he was going to fire Comey regardless. He's particularly upset that Comey told a congressional hearing that he felt queasy that his decision on the Clinton emails may have influenced the election.
I was going to fire Comey. My decision. It was not.
You had made the decision before they came in the room.
I was going to fire Comey. There's no good time to do it, by the way.
Because in your letter you said I accepted their recommendation.
Yeah, well,
so you had already made the decision.
I was going to fire regardless of recommendation.
So there was really room.
He made a recommendation. He's highly respected. Very good guy. Very smart guy. The Democrats like him. The Republicans like him. He made a recommendation. But regardless of recommendation, I was going to fire Comey.
So when Holt asked Trump what was his real problem with Comey, the president replied with a sort of pot-meat-kettle response.
He's a showboat. He's a grandstander. The FBI has been in turmoil. You know that. I know that. Everybody knows that. You take a look at the FBI a year ago. It was in virtual turmoil less than a year ago. It hasn't recovered from that.
So, of course, we have questions about the Russian investigation swirling. And then there was the firing letter to Comey, in which the president thanked Comey for telling him three times that the president wasn't under investigation, which is something that Comey's camp denies. Here again is President Trump.
He said it once at dinner, and then he said it twice during phone calls.
Did you call him?
In one case, I called him. In one case, he called me.
And did you ask, am I under investigation?
I actually asked him, yes. I said, if it's possible, would you let me know, am I under investigation? He said, you are not under investigation.
But he's given sworn testimony that there is an ongoing investigation into the Trump campaign and possible collusion with the Russian government. You were the centerpiece of the Trump campaign.
Well,
so was he being truthful when he says you weren't under investigation?
I know that I'm not under investigation, me personally. I'm not talking about campaigns. I'm not talking about anything else. I'm not under investigation.
And then, of course, we have the tweet from the president warning Comey that there are, quote, tapes to back him up, which, of course, Comey's camp denies ever saying that the president was not under investigation. Obviously, all of these questions about Russia, and very interesting, CBS reporter Elizabeth Palmer caught up with the Russian president, Vladimir Putin, as Putin was preparing to play in a hockey game.
Sir, how will the firing of James Comey international relations.
Как повлияет это увольнение на двусторонние отношения?
Увольнение. Да никак не повлияет.
There will be no effect.
Ваш вопрос выглядит... Вы не сердитесь, пожалуйста. Он выглядит смешным для меня.
Your question looks very funny for me. Don't be angry with me.
Мы не имеем к этому никакого отношения.
We have nothing to do with that.
Президент Трамп действует в рамках своей компетенции.
President Trump is acting in accordance with his competence and in accordance with his law and constitution.
Мы здесь при чем?
And what about us? Why we?
Я вот видите, в хоккей собираюсь играть с любителями.
You see, I'm going to play hockey with the hockey fans.
And yes, that's Vladimir Putin and his translator speaking to CBS before he went on. Apparently his team won with 11 goals, and according to the reports, the Russian president scored 8 of them. So there you have the latest news from Russia. Switching gears now, we're joined on the phone by Republican State Senator Bill Brady of Bloomington, a member of the Republican leadership team. Senator, good morning.
Good morning. Happy Mother's Day to all those mothers who are listening and all the mothers in Illinois.
Yes, and what a beautiful day today. Just a glorious day today. Thank you so much for getting up with me this morning. And I wanted to, obviously, kind of news was breaking a week ago about efforts to try to revive what everybody has been calling the grand bargain, these talks between Senate Democrats and Senate Republicans in Springfield to try to find some way to get us out of this historic budget impasse. And when we, you know, that kind of came a week ago, then everybody leaves Springfield and you have Senate President John Cullerton saying Democrats have gone as far as they can go. And this is where it ends. We have no resolution. Senate Republicans say, let's keep talking. What's going on?
Well, you're right. We do say, let's keep talking. There's just too much at risk. This state has been without a budget. Speaker Madigan has not been willing to negotiate at the table. I will give Senate President Cullerton and my leader, Chris Rodogno, great credit for bringing us as close as we've come. And we've come pretty close. When the speaker just didn't seem to want to negotiate on the budget at the end of last Thanksgiving, they put our staffs together and started working on a solution that would be balanced, that would have cuts in spending, that would have revenues, would have property tax relief, business reforms. That agreement came together pretty closely with the exception of a budget, and frankly, our Republican members couldn't see passing what was called then the grand bargain without a real budget. As someone who was asked to negotiate some of the revenues and the business reforms by my leader, Senator Rodogno, as the deputy leader of the caucus, I began that process and also began the process of putting a budget together that we introduced. And frankly, the Democrats have negotiated in good faith on over the last couple of weeks. We are very close. There's still some issues. We think it's just paramount that property tax relief be part of this package. If we're going to ask the citizens to pay temporary revenues, they need property tax freeze. Business reforms have to be in place. That's what we missed in the last tax increase because there weren't business reforms. Jobs didn't grow in revenues. This calls for a spending cap that presumably in 4 years would allow the 1.2% increase in revenues to fall off and be balanced because of growth in our economy based on the business reforms.
So I know we keep hearing close, but what really is the sticking point? Is it the issue of property taxes? Is it the issue of changes in workers' compensation? I mean, what is the real sticking point here?
I think everything is real close. We still don't have a balanced budget. We're very close. We've narrowed the gap down. We still need some more cuts. I think our discussions with the Democrats this week, we could resolve that issue. There are some fundamental differences on the four-year property tax freeze with the Democrats. We want to make sure it's meaningful. And not that they don't, but they're concerned, and are looking for more ways out of the freeze. We think a referendum is by the people is a healthy way for someone to get out of property tax freeze if that's what they want. On the work comp reforms, we've still got some key issues to the business community. You know, we're asking the business community to pay a higher corporate tax and some other things. So you think it's fair that they get some meaningful reforms. And frankly, the work comp, I wish we were going to be the best in the nation, but we're only working toward being middle cost in terms of that, which is the highest cost, still protecting injured workers. So I think that the time of all the discussions, learning about it, we've gotten down to a point where we have identified there's just some minor issues with AMA guidelines on work comp, with what would be exempt under the property tax freeze, and then narrowing a couple $100 million hole in the budget, all doable this week. I understand Senator Colton's caucus's frustration. I appreciate that. I hope, I think a little bit of an overreaction last week, although he's the president of the Senate. I understand his frustration, but I think we still are on the road. The governor's given us good assistance in terms of the budget, and he's out there fighting with us for property tax freezes and business reforms as well. So, but our caucus needs to have those things to join the Democrats in a bipartisan effort to pass something over to the House.
I want to ask you about some of the components here, and you touched on the fact of it would be a 4-year increase in the personal income tax going to 4.95% from the current 3.75. What about as far as the service tax that's been talked about?
Well, as you know, the economy and our economy's growth really relies on services and has been in services. Every surrounding state, I believe, has service taxes. We've analyzed what those were and tried to make sure that we didn't create any unlevel playing fields or disadvantages to businesses. So this budget introduces the concept of excise taxes on services to bring in revenue. The trigger date would be the first of the year. That would give us a half a year's revenue for 18 and a full year after that. But as you well know, it's important in tax policy to broaden the base and keep rates as low as possible. This makes that introduction into that avenue as the surrounding states of Illinois have done.
So this would we're broadening the base, but would it reduce the state sales tax rate?
It's not, but it's going to keep it from going up at this point. But our goal is, you know, because we've been under a court-ordered spending plan, you know, we're spending in excess of $6 billion a year more than we're bringing in. We have estimates of $13 billion in unpaid bills. So it's very difficult for us to be truthful with the taxpayers and talk about reducing the rate on and by expanding the base, but it does allow us to have a balanced budget and keep rates low and hopefully even lower after the 4-year period when we're working our way out of this, frankly, financial disaster. But that is the plan, and hopefully as our economy grows, we will be able to reduce the base rates after 4 years.
We're speaking with Republican State Senator Bill Brady of Bloomington. Senator, in talking about kind of revenue issues, I know one thing that has caused some concern among municipalities would be the potential loss of some of their share of the state income tax. Is there an agreement that that's going to happen?
Well, listen, we've had to look at every area of state government. When you've got a structural deficit of $10 billion, court-ordered spending, and $13 billion in unpaid bills, there's some every area is going to have to help. We have found a mechanism, though, that where we will be reducing some of the local distributive fund. Actually, every year in this plan, the local municipalities will get more money from the state than they got the previous year. We're doing some of that by speeding up some cash flow payments to them in dedicated funds. So we've tried to take great care in not putting too much burden on anybody, although everyone is going to have to help us solve this. And the good news is for the local governments is that in aggregate, they will continue to receive more than they did the year before in this plan. But yes, there is a first year reduction in that distributive fund. But as I said, we've taken care to hold them, so to speak, harmless in the plan from not losing money over the previous year.
So this would be like accelerating payments like such as done has been done in the past for
right.
schools kind of thing?
Right. One of the things we're finding is that the lag that we're, money is receipted, goes in, has to be appropriated, paid out. If we can streamline that effect, we can help their cash flow, save some money for the state in that first year, and keep them whole throughout the process. So it's a mechanism that helps us speed up the cash flow, as you indicated.
What are we looking at as far as cuts? What cuts that and obviously, you know, to put together a package, I think everybody has said, theoretically, well, we can't do it cuts alone, we can't do it tax increases alone. But, I mean, when it comes to actually making cuts, that's always the hardest part, isn't it?
Right. So the budget that I introduced called for about $5.1 billion in cuts and savings. And part of the savings comes from pension savings, again, bringing into conformity some of the ways in which we account for pension contributions and so forth. It also calls for a new Tier 3 pension. One of the arguments has been that, and this is a, you can call it a cut and a shift, is that school districts and local universities have had the ability to pay, and then we're stuck with a pension. We're moving into a local responsible pension, a pension that's partially owned, like a defined contribution. That saves about a half of $1 billion. Higher ed is taking a cut of nearly 10%. All of state government is taking a cut of approximately 5% across the board to meet these demands, with the exception of education, because of the property tax freeze and because of the importance we have for education funding. Chicago has its challenges, others. We're actually increasing the funding to education, hopefully pass a new funding program. Medicaid, we found some areas in which we can make some savings in the Medicaid area, particularly with the hospital assessment. So, but when you rack the whole thing up, every area of government, with the exception of education, is helping us solve that $5 billion hole that we're trying to use to balance with revenues. I think the important point is, though, here is that the revenues we're asking for, I believe, will be offset by the property tax freeze. That's why it's so important that we get a good property tax freeze for the people. I don't know about the ones that you talk to, but people I talk to are so concerned about their ever escalating and the highest property taxes in the nation. And a key component to this plan is not just the revenues, not just the cuts, not just that this budget needs to be balanced, but the property tax relief that every Illinois resident of a home will receive.
I know, you know, education, obviously a chief concern here. Also higher education and the fact of what's been going on at states' institutions of higher education. But also on this issue of property tax and property tax freeze, you have local community colleges that are dependent on property taxes. And I mean, to me, it raises questions, you know, how do you support community college system while also, you know, in some respects hamstringing their ability to raise money?
You're right. And community colleges are probably one of the most, I think, undervalued, because they have great value to all of our citizens, not only to building a continued workforce and retraining workforce, but for a lot of folks, that's their entry into higher education. The good news is that this budget will, for the first time in a couple of years, give them stability to know what they're going to receive. Yes, we are freezing the property taxes, but let's think about the fact that we're freezing state government spending under this plan, with a spending cap as well. So we're asking everyone to tighten their belt and live within their means. I think the community colleges that I have talked to will be just satisfied knowing what they're going to get with a 10% cut, that they'll be able to rely on those resources and not have to worry about, not to mention the MAP grant funding that we're giving them and others. So the people I've talked to don't like the fact that they're going to have to make things work on less, but for the most part, and for a great part, are happy to know that if we have something that's stable, they'll learn to live within the reduced revenues as Illinois citizens have had to do, as the state government will do, and bring that balance is what we so critically need. Because everyone knows until we get that balance, it's going to be very difficult to grow our economy and jobs. This balance gets us, I think, out of those discussions about junk bond status for various things, gets us out of the discussion about, you know, unpaid bills, moves us forward, gives some sense of reliance, and therefore, I think, creates jobs, which is really the real solution to Illinois' economy.
The governor has alluded in recent days to his belief, and he did this the last time that efforts were being made towards this, quote, grand bargain, unquote, about agents of House Speaker Michael Madigan working in the Senate to try to kill any deal. What do you know about that?
Well, there's been some suspicion that, and that many people have said that the speaker really doesn't want a deal, that he would prefer to have forced the governor into going to an election without a budget. I hope that's not true, but you know how cynical people can be around the Capitol.
No. It's the most optimistic and cheery bunch of people.
Yeah. But I do think we all know that Speaker Madigan cares deeply about politics. And there are some that would say that would be the best political move for J.B. Pritzker or Chris Kennedy or whoever. What we're trying to do here, and I think the governor's trying to do in my discussions, is put policy ahead of politics. This is a situation that needs to be fixed. I personally think that in spite of some of those allegations that the speaker's been behind some bipartisan efforts to derail things in the Senate, I think we're going to be successful, and when that happens, I think there'll be a lot of pressure from the speaker's own Democratic members who've signed letters, Republicans. There will be a lot of pressure in that chamber to move forward with this if we can come to a bipartisan agreement in the Senate. So in spite of the rumors that he may have tried to mingle a little bit, of course, probably the first time he's ever tried to mingle in the Senate, I'm kidding, there are, I think, great abilities to overcome that and put something over there that is a good, solid plan. When we send something over there that's balanced, that has property tax relief, balances cuts with revenues, spending cap, it'll be very, very difficult, I think, for the speaker to hold back, particularly Democrat members, from pursuing the passage of that plan.
That's Republican State Senator Bill Brady of Bloomington, a member of the Senate Republican leadership team, discussing issues towards will we ever get a deal on a grand bargain. Senator Brady, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Rick, thanks so much for having me. And again, happy Mother's Day. It's what a beautiful day we're going to have here in Illinois.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome to the second hour of your Sunday Spin on this beautiful, beautiful Mother's Day in downtown Chicago. Joining me now on the phone is State Senator Michael Hastings, Democrat from Tinley Park. And I wanted to have Senator Hastings on because last week we had a representative from the Chicagoland Chamber of Commerce talking about its group's opposition to Senator Hastings' bill known as the Right to Know Act. Senator, thank you very much for joining me this morning.
Rick, good morning, and to all the mothers, happy Mother's Day out there.
Indeed, indeed. As I said, you've got this bill, the Right to Know Act, and it's, you know, it's an effort to try to deal with the you know, it's even what we have in the news today about this worldwide kind of cyber attack that's been hitting, and an effort to try to protect data, protect privacy rights of people that use online services. Could you just outline what this bill does?
Sure. First and foremost, Rick, I think consumers, you know, they must be better informed about what kinds of personal information are shared with businesses. Businesses, they have an $84 billion market of collecting your information online, selling it through advertising and various other companies. This bill would give consumers the right to know what data is actually being collected on them and who that information is being disclosed and sold to. I think it's very important, especially in this day and age. I think after yesterday's global cyber attack, I think it's important for people to be secure and feel as if their information is protected.
Now, one of the things that the Chicagoland Chamber said is that this bill, maybe as they consider it as unintended consequences, is that this bill would require businesses to actually compile data that they don't normally keep, and that basically that it's driven by litigation.
You know, Rick, no offense to your radio show, because I think it's great, but that was last week was the greatest 11 minutes and 52 seconds of the Spin Zone.
You timed that out, did you? You had the stopwatch running, huh?
I had it going, and I can tell you that the Chicagoland Chamber of Commerce couldn't have misinformed your listeners any greater. This bill is a great bill for consumers because there's information, whether it's your age, gender, race, income, health concerns, religion, and it even goes as far as sexual orientation, sexual preference. These companies are selling it to third parties. This bill doesn't require any business to maintain information. There's businesses out there right now that already do this. And, you know, as a consumer, if you're using an internet site, if you're, you know, going and visiting and entering information, you should know what information they're storing and selling to third parties. Now, if you don't collect, maintain, and or disclose the information to someone else, this law doesn't concern to you. It doesn't apply to you. And like I said, they couldn't have spun it in a more worse way to make it sound horrible. But for a consumer, you should have the right to know what information's out there and what's being sold.
Is there any provision in this that, I mean, let's someone opt out of, as a consumer, to opt out of having their information sold?
Yeah, they can opt out. You know, the one thing that really, you know, disturbed me about last week's interview is the fact that they said that this is a class action lawyer's bill. Nowhere in this bill does it allow for a private right of action, someone to go ahead and sue a company. The one thing that it does do is it allows the attorney general, who is charged with protecting and, you know, bringing complaints on behalf of the people of Illinois, it gives her the ability to do this. So, you know, for me, it's just one of those tough things where misinformation's out there, and I think it's important to clear that information up.
Where does this legislation stand in the process?
So we had over 20 sponsors in the Senate, and we passed it out of the Senate. This is landmark legislation in terms of protecting people's privacy. Now it's on to the House. The House has 43 sponsors. Rick, you and I both know that 43 sponsors in the House of Representatives on a bill is a very unusual thing. And I anticipate there being a lot more coming on board because people back home tell their representatives that they have a reasonable expectation of privacy online and that they should protect their information. And that's what this bill does.
Has there been any effort, though, to try to ameliorate that opposition that's out there from some of these groups?
We have some of the opposition, and it's genuine opposition. Some people, for example, small businesses. Now, Chicago is an excellent tech hub. It's 1871, obviously funded by Mr. J.B. Pritzker. He ended up this incubator of putting young people and getting their businesses to grow. This bill, I told the sponsor in the House as well, you know, we want to make sure we don't curb innovation, entrepreneurship, growth of our tech sector in Illinois. And we actually made a provision in there for small businesses to exempt them from this if they go ahead and if they are collecting, maintaining, and selling the information. But I could tell you I've had four amendments on my Senate bill. I know there were seven amendments on the House bill. If that's not evidence enough of us trying to work with everybody to make this the best bill, I don't know what is.
don't know if you had a chance to listen to Senator Bill Brady's interview this morning, talking about the issues of trying to continue negotiating that so-called grand bargain. And I know that Senate President John Cullerton on last week basically said that Senate Democrats have gone as far as they can in trying to accommodate Republican wishes in trying to reach this grand bargain. Where do you see things sitting as Senate Republicans say they want to continue to talk?
I you can always keep on talking, but there's some facts here that have to be stated. Number one, it's been 121 days since the grand bargain was introduced, and there's been 35 negotiated changes and reforms since January 11th. The fact of the matter is that there's been an overwhelming amount of evidence that the governor and his team of appointees are mismanaging almost every area of government. We've had almost every agency now sitting in front of the State Appropriations Committee asking them, where will you cut? Where will you cut? Where can we find additional revenue streams? And the answer to that is silence. They cannot answer the question. And to me, that's troubling.
Is it a matter that, I mean, that the governor and the administration have to come up with their concepts of cuts for Democrats to go along?
You know, part of being the governor of the state is actually being a leader and actually leading. You just can't sit there and do nothing for 2 years and then decide to spend millions of dollars on TV commercials and tour the state for a reelection campaign. I don't think that's governing. Every day, Bruce Rauner forces a delay. And there's a cost to this chaos. And I think everybody should know that, you know, every day is $11 million a day that it costs the taxpayers. $13 billion in backlog of unpaid bills. I asked the governor's budget director, are we in a better position today than before when the governor took office? And, you know, he has a hard time answering the questions. If you can't figure out by now the lack of governing by this governor hasn't caused problems. Now, I understand the past is the past, but look, you get paid to lead people and lead our state. And that's all I'm asking for.
So where do we go from here?
Well, you know, last week, you know, we ended up calling one grand bargain bill, and then we ended up calling two other ones that were sponsored by Senator Redonio. And on the Republican side, they say they need more time. And to me, I mean, 121 days, everyone knows what needs to get done. The issue is it's that it's campaign season's coming up in 2018, and some of these people have a really hard time taking a tough vote. They haven't taken a tough vote in the last 10 years. And in my district, one of my state reps, Rick, I'll never forget this to the day I die. She says, well, I want this project, I want this project, I want this project, but I can't vote for the revenue to go ahead and pay for it. If that's not a problem, I don't know what is.
Well, that's a time-honored tradition in Springfield. We've seen that before. I'm still of kind of the belief that there should be maybe a capital construction component to this grand bargain. I mean, there is something to the effect of having the ability to asking people for raising taxes and facing cuts. There still is kind of the belief, I think, among many that if they've got something to bring home to show for it, that's enough leverage.
I don't disagree with you, Rick, in terms of there needing to be some sort of a capital plan for Illinois' infrastructure. There's no doubt about that. But the fact of the matter is that there's some issues that the executive branch wants that may not be of, you know, our persuasion or our liking. And, you know, that's where compromise has to come in. Now, Senator Brady and Senator McCarter, they've given out some ideas in terms of what would reduce some of the spending. I like some of those ideas. I truly do. And I think, you know, through conversations with Senator Brady and Senator McCarter, I think, you know, there's some great ideas. Number one being reducing the statutory interest that we have to pay when we do this, when we have other people buy our debt. So we pay 12% interest. We actually statutorily put that on ourselves so that we don't do it, you know, on a reoccurring basis. You know, we have the ability to statutorily change that interest payment. That can save millions of dollars in interest payment. We also have the ability to refinance some of our pension debt. I think that's a no-brainer. I think that's a no-brainer, and it saves, again, millions and millions of dollars to one of our biggest areas of our budget.
What are the chances of really, what are the chances of anything happening? Because I just kind of see, I just keep seeing this as a stalemated issue. And part of it, too, is, you know, not necessarily knowing if something were to pass the Senate, which obviously very difficult votes involved in this package, passing the Senate and going over to the House and the uncertain fate that it would face there.
You know, they say, you know, the governor and Senate Republicans, they say they need more time. You know, that's just very troubling. I think if I was to, since I think it was May, since today, it's been 683 days since Illinois has had a budget. You know, we've made 30 changes to the grand bargain in order to find a compromise. You know, our state's hurting and families are worried about schools opening on time. Seniors, at least in my district, are struggling for seniors' Meals on Wheels. I think it's time that we give people stability and security they need. And I can just tell you right now, you know, the governor has to lead, and he's not doing that. And it's very evident. I mean, 683 days without a budget, the governor is constitutionally required to introduce a balanced budget. He hasn't done that since day one. I think it's time. Lead. Just lead.
Do you see us getting to a point where really it would take something like not having a school appropriation to force things?
That would cause chaos, Rick. That's the last thing I want to see.
I understand, I understand, but nevertheless, I mean, as things have drawn out in this, and I've always said it would take something regrettably catastrophic to maybe, you know, break the logjam here. And certainly to me, in my mind, the most pressing thing would be a failure to pass education appropriation.
Yeah, I'm not willing to do that, Rick. I'd say right now, the kids in our community, they deserve to go to school, especially out in the suburbs. People pay property taxes to send their kids to school. That would cause pretty much chaos. I think we all need to be adults here and do our jobs. I think that's probably the most important thing, is do our jobs and make sure we do what we said we were going to do. And unfortunately, there's people in our government that just don't do that because they're up for re-election.
So is it just as a default, we'll have an education appropriation? I mean, and maybe nothing else?
You know, that could be a possibility.
I mean, we've seen that before.
Yeah, but the goal, you know, like I said, 683 days without a budget, our community colleges, social services, you know, businesses, that goes far down as to domestic violence shelters in the South suburbs. These people demand and they deserve a full budget. When I was on the school board, we had a $130 million budget. We were able to balance it and pass it every year. We could do that at the state level. It just takes leadership. And right now we have a void in that. And we just need to keep working with each other. And, you know, like I said, be adults and do what we're supposed to do.
But sometimes that's easier said than done. I mean,
it is when you're up for re-election, Rick.
Well, yeah. And I mean, truly, that also is part of where, you know, regretfully, I don't see anything happening because we're well into the 2018 campaign on both sides.
Yeah. Well, in the event that the governor chooses not to come to an agreement, which I think he can, you know, and that's something he's going to have to answer to people about. And that's what everyone who represents, you know, a district in Illinois, they're going to have to answer to their people. And to me, I go around my district and we talk to people on a consistent basis. I tell them what my ideas are. How are we going to balance the budget? What would you reduce? What would you do to change things? I think people understand what needs to be changed. People are willing to agree and accept to some of these things. But there has to be some shared sacrifice as well, Rick. And, you know, in some areas, you know, our state needs to sort of stop spending what we're spending.
One of these things that's part of the grand bargain is a proposed, you know, property tax freeze, and I know that's a area that's in some dispute on both sides. But you know, when I still look at things like the property tax freeze and then taking away some of the local government share of the income tax at the same time, if that just doesn't create some kind of dichotomy that's not workable.
Well, first and foremost, the governor's version of a property tax freeze is a facade. There's exceptions. We voted on 5 property tax freeze bills so far in the Senate, and they've all passed. But in these property tax freezes, there's these exemptions, whether that be for public safety, infrastructure, new property being built. So when you're out there selling this property tax freeze, as the governor's doing, the last thing you want to see is a property tax bill go up, because the voter's going to be like, well, you told me it was a property tax freeze and my bill went up. I think he needs to be very truthful with the voters out there in terms of what does he actually mean by a property tax freeze. I can tell you it's very concerning to me. Now, the local government distributive fund, which is it's essential to municipalities. A lot of municipalities, they base their budget on the funds that they're going to get from this. And when it was created, it's actually the municipal's money going to the state, being filtered and coming right back to the state. I think it's important that the governor realize that, you know, reductions in the local government distributive fund is going to hurt municipalities. And if you go ahead and add on to that property tax freezes, it's only going to hurt municipalities more. So he's got to come up with a better plan.
That's Democratic State Senator Michael Hastings from Tinley Park. Senator, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Rick, it's always good to be with you, my friend. Tell the family we said hello.
Will do, and same to yours.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning. Happy Mother's Day. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase Studio in Tribune Tower on North Michigan Avenue, and this is your Sunday Spin. We've been talking this morning about the crazy week in Washington, the firing of FBI Director James Comey, and the president apparently had thought ostensibly that he would get Democratic backing from those angry at Comey for weighing in during the election. Instead, though, it's created a backlash among Democrats. Here's Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren on MSNBC.
Sally Yates was acting attorney general, and one of the things she told the Trump administration was that his inner circle advisor, Flynn, was compromised by the Russians, and she gets fired. Preet Bharara is the U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York. He's the one who has jurisdiction over any investigation into what happened at Trump Tower. And after Donald Trump originally embraced him and said he wanted to keep him on, Preet gets fired. And now it turns out that James Comey, who says he has an active and ongoing investigation, will not rule out investigating Donald Trump directly and the connection with the Trump campaign and the Russians. And now James Comey gets fired. You put those together, and it's pretty clear what's going on here. Donald Trump doesn't want anyone coming any place close to an active investigation into the relationship between the Russians, the Trump campaign, and Donald Trump himself.
And of course, you have Senate Democratic Leader Chuck Schumer of New York leading the calls for an independent investigation, something only a few Republicans have joined.
This investigation must be run as far away as possible from this White House and as far away as possible from anyone that President Trump has appointed. Given the way the president fired Director Comey, any person who he appoints to lead the Russia investigation will be concerned that he or she will meet the same fate as Director Comey if they run afoul of the administration. The American people need to have faith that an investigation as serious as this one is being conducted impartially without a shred of bias.
So it looks like it will be rocky times in Washington with the pending nomination of a new FBI director. That's our weekly spin through national politics. Joining me now here in the Allstate Showcase studio is Rod Joy. He's executive director of Change Illinois. Rod, welcome to the show. And why don't you just explain for folks what Change Illinois is?
It's good to be back.
Always good to have you, and thank you for the donut holes, by the way.
I think the last time I was here was your birthday. It's not your birthday today, so these donuts don't have bacon, but I hope you enjoy them just the same.
Absolutely. Thank you for thinking of us.
Listening to your setup, I'm reminded of the old ancient Chinese curse, may you live in interesting times. Unlike what's happening in Washington, I'm really pleased because I'm here to share some good news about what's happening in Springfield.
Finally, some good news.
Finally, some good news, and we have our fingers and toes crossed that we'll see this thing through. But to provide your listeners with a little bit of background about Change Illinois, Change is a statewide public policy and political reform coalition. We serve and represent a diverse network of organizations and individuals that have two things in common. One is a commitment to strengthen our democracy, and the second is a commitment to build a more vibrant culture of civic participation in our state. You know, I think what's going on now is really disheartening. You know, our politics has become plagued by hyperpolarization and partisan gridlock. At all levels of government, we've seen a bottoming out of the public's trust in our public institutions. And the Game of Thrones winner-take-all approach to governing that we see breeds cynicism, and it discourages people from getting involved in public life. And we're committed to fixing that. And we think there are two ways to restore faith in our democracy. The first is we have to change the systems. We have to change the rules that govern political participation to make them more fair, functional, and inclusive. The second thing we have to do is to get more people actively involved in public life. We have to get them to tune in, pay attention, and climb the ladder of civic engagement. The good news for Illinois is with automatic voter registration, we have an opportunity to do both of those things, change the systems and get more people involved in public life.
Well, and the good news that you're here to talk about is the fact that the Senate, I believe, voted 47 to nothing.
It's 48.
48.
Give me that extra one.
I don't want to cheat you out of a vote there. 48 to nothing on this bill that's been a long time in the process to basically create automatic voter registration in Illinois. Tell us how it would work.
Well, this is a really big deal, and it represents a giant step forward for democratic participation in our state. Automatic voter registration is a paradigm shift in how we register voters and how we carry out elections.
It's basically reversing the system as it exists
now. There are two fundamental changes that AVR represents. The first is it upgrades our system so that voter information can be transferred electronically and securely from the DMV and other state agencies to the State Board of Elections. That's one change. The other fundamental change is it creates an opt-out system instead of an opt-in system when it comes to registering to vote.
So explain that.
So right now, citizens have to take action in order to be added to the voter rolls. You have to take a step to register to vote. The burden is on the citizen. In almost every developed democracy in the world, the burden is on the government, and citizens have to opt out. And essentially, that's the change that AVR would bring to Illinois. When individuals do business with the state, when they applied for a driver's license or renew their driver's license, they would be presented with the option to opt out of being a registered voter as opposed to opting in. And right now, there are about 2 million voters in Illinois who are eligible to be on the rolls but have not yet taken action to be added. We believe that AVR would do a number of things. It would get more people involved in the electoral process, and it would make our election system more secure, modern, and efficient.
Well, and it would also kind of streamline things, too, that when you move and update your driver's license or that kind of thing, that would automatically be reflected.
Absolutely. You know, I think, first and foremost, it would make our lists more secure, and it protects against errors. You know, right now, 1 in 8 voter registrations in America is invalid or contains incomplete information. And a lot of that, as you just mentioned, has to do with people moving. I think the national estimates are 1 in 9 people move every year. And many of those people, when they move, fail to update their voter registration rolls. So with AVR, we'll reduce the chance that anyone will be able to be left out of the system when they move. And we'll make sure that our voter rolls are more accurate, secure, and efficient.
Now, there was a version of this bill that had passed previously, and the governor's office had raised some objections to it. What has changed to try to meet those objections?
Yeah, first, let me give a shout out to a voting rights collaborative called Just Democracy Illinois. Yes. It's essentially kind of like the Jedi Knights of the democracy reform space in our state. It's the Justice League of Illinois, and Just Democracy has been fighting hard for 2 years to make AVR a reality. We thought we were there last year. We had a bill that had broad bipartisan support. Unfortunately, when it landed on the governor's desk, he vetoed it. I will say the good news about this year's attempt is it's been a symbol of bipartisan cooperation. You know, we essentially took the Republican version of the AVR bill that was introduced last year, and we use that as a starting point for negotiations this year. We have been in close communication, not just with the governor's office, but with all of the key players and elected officials. We essentially are still looking at, you know, kind of three things. One is creating an upfront opt-out, which addresses some of the concerns about this leading to voter fraud, although there's no evidence to back that up. We're ensuring that this system is aligned with the Real ID and the Secretary of State's office to implement Real ID next year. And we're also looking at some adjustments with the agencies that are involved. And so we've informed by some of the feedback that we've received, we've added a number of agencies, including the Illinois Department of Natural Resources.
The issue of Real ID, I think, is one that's important, because that kind of goes to the more extensive driver's license and background check information that the Secretary of State's office will be conducting as far as, you know, citizenship and all those kinds of things.
That's correct. But I will say, and I think this goes back to kind of how you set up this segment about what's happening in Washington, there's a false narrative out there around voter fraud in America. And it reminds me of the difference between math and politics. In math, something times zero will always equal zero. In politics, you can introduce an idea that has no basis in fact, but if you repeat it and repeat it and repeat it, people start to buy into it. And that's what I think about this whole chatter about widespread voter fraud. And President Trump, just last week,
created a commission
to, which is interesting because it's framed as looking at election integrity, but it's not coming from a space that has any integrity whatsoever. But it's designed to really get after these baseless claims of voter fraud, when the facts show that you're more likely to be standing next to someone who's struck by lightning than to be standing next to someone who will commit in-person voter fraud.
We do have a question from Charlie. Charlie, welcome to the Sunday Spin.
Thank you. Thank you. Love your show.
Thank you.
Hey, I got a question. All right, I'm an election judge. I'm in Joliet. Last election, we had about 11 to 15% turnout. What do we do to get more people out to vote? I mean, you can register everybody in the state, but you're still not going to get them out to vote. And secondly, what I think is more important, of that 11 to 15%, say 150 people voted in my precinct, five or six were under the age of 30. How do we get the young? How do we get the quote-unquote youngsters out?
All right, Charlie, thanks. Two very good questions.
Charlie, thanks for your call and your question and your service. We'll say AVR is a proven model. It already exists in some capacity in seven states and the District of Columbia. Oregon was the first state to adopt AVR, and we're starting to see some promising results when it comes to voter turnout and participation, particularly for young people, as you mentioned. So I think since AVR's implementation in this last election, Oregon added almost 500,000 people to the voter rolls. They saw a 20 percentage point increase in the youth turnout. So that was an increase of 20 points from 2012 to 2016. They also saw a dramatic increase of the voter rates for communities of color, which rose by 26% from December 2015 to January 2017. And I want to just echo some of the things that Charlie mentioned about the power and importance of voting. You know, study after study shows that voting leads to important indicators, growth indicators of civic vitality. Compared to non-voters, voters are more likely to volunteer, to contact their elected officials, to stay informed about local affairs. Voters versus non-voters are more likely to contribute to their neighborhood's social capital. Being a voter is associated with better health outcomes, reduced unemployment, lower recidivism rates, and the first step to get more people to vote is to get them registered. And we're really excited that we're on the verge of bringing automatic voter registration to Illinois. And we really want to thank the lawmakers who have embraced this on both sides of the aisle to have 22 Republicans in this atmosphere vote to support AVR in the Senate is quite encouraging. And we're hopeful that we'll see continued progress as it moves through the House.
And, you know, one thing, too, with Charlie's comment, and it was something that we'd talked about in the past on this show about the efforts to require the teaching of civics in the state of Illinois. And they'll, you know, inculcate youth with the idea of what it means to be engaged.
And we've seen some progress here in Illinois. I know the McCormick Foundation has been leading the charge. We're really committed to boosting civic knowledge and civic skills that people need to practice the art of citizenship. And I think you're right that that also relates to civics in our schools.
One other issue that Change Illinois is involved with has been the issue of redistricting, the issue of changing the current system about how Illinois draws its boundaries for legislative elections. And of course, we've seen a couple of petition drives to use the Citizens Initiative effort under the Constitution to do it, which the court basically has effectively struck down.
That hurt my feelings and it left scars.
So I shouldn't have brought this up.
It's okay. It's not going anywhere. And that's another piece of the puzzle. You know, we applaud Republicans who are doing the right thing on automatic voter registration, and I think it's important that Democrats step up and show leadership when it comes to redistricting. It's no secret that our current redistricting process is bad for our democracy. It eliminates competition, and it guarantees incumbent power. We all can agree that competitive elections are an important component of a healthy democracy, yet in Illinois, competitive elections are you know, kind of like an endangered species. You know, we saw because of gerrymandered maps. I think in the House, 59% of the folks who ran unopposed in November. And in the Senate, 70% of state senators ran unopposed. We're continuing to fight to bring fair and responsible redistricting to the state. Essentially where we are, I'd love to come back and spend more time on this topic. We've engaged not only the folks who were leading the fight for the independent map amendment, but we've also brought new leaders and new organizations into the fold. And essentially, we're focused on three things. One is documenting and applying some of the lessons learned from last year. There were some tough lessons learned from the state Supreme Court. But we also are celebrating accomplishments. We engage hundreds of thousands of voters from all corners of the state. We still are in contact with a lot of those voters and stakeholders. We're working right now on values and principles. Before we put both feet on the gas for a new reform proposal, we want to make sure that we have broad buy-in for the values that we want to drive the next redistricting process, regardless of who draws the lines. And then the third component is really looking at redistricting strategies and how we can improve the system in the lead up to 2021. And all options are on the table, whether it's mounting another citizen petition, looking at a legislative initiative, looking at legislative reforms, looking at the courts as an avenue to improve our process. That very much is an issue that's alive and well and top of mind for Change and all of our stakeholders.
Well, we will have you back and we'll be talking about this.
I'll bring bacon next time.
With that, there's definitely a promise. Rod Joy, Executive Director of Change Illinois, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Thanks for having me.